Thank you, sir.
You're welcome. Is Mr. Whitmer on the line with us?
Yes, I'm here, Your Honor.
Okay, good. Well, then we'll move on to the case of Jones versus the Commonwealth. Mr. Bogera?
Yes, Your Honor, thank you. If please the court, I'd like to reserve 5 minutes, if I may, for rebuttal.
Yes,
may it please the court, my name is Keith Bogera, and I do represent Mr. Crosby Jones in this matter. Mr. Jones avers that this is a relatively simple case about a motion to strike and the sufficiency of the evidence. There is a case I'd like to bring to the court's attention, which is Fountain v. Commonwealth. The site on that is 64 Virginia App 51. That was released in 2014, just in November. I was catching up yesterday on some reading and came across it, and I thought it was very relevant to the case at hand. In Fountain, it's a case with about calling 911 with an intent to, you know, harass or, you know, delay. And in the case, as it came out, the judge found in the case that the defendant did not have an intent to annoy, harass, etc. at the time the phone call was made. But having made that finding, convicted the defendant anyway. And in that case, it was written, the opinion written, of course, by Judge McCullough, so he's probably more familiar than I am with it. But it was the holding of the court that even though there was a question about whether the issue had been properly preserved, that the defendant had, in fact, raised the issue of whether the defendant had that proper intent at the time of the telephone call in the motion to strike, and therefore the issue was properly preserved. Here we have basically the same situation. The court made a finding that Mr. Crosby Jones did not have an intent to maim, disfigure, disable, or kill at the time he attacked the victim, but he convicted him of malicious wounding anyway. In our motion to strike on this case, the issue of there not being enough proof of intent to maim, disfigure, disable, or kill was clearly raised more than once in the motion to strike, and we would argue that, therefore, that argument has been properly preserved, and in light of the finding by the court, which I believe is clear, that there is no evidence, no proof of an intent to maim, disfigure, disable, or kill, that therefore the evidence is in fact insufficient as a matter of law, and we're asking the court to go ahead and reverse the conviction.
Does the defendant have any obligation when he was either at the time the court actually convicted him of unlawful wounding, which I think is on page 94 of the appendix, and then again when he actually sentenced him, he found him guilty again at sentencing and gave him a penitentiary sentence. Doesn't the defendant have some obligation at that time to point out to the court that you have made a finding that precludes a conviction for this offense?
No, Judge Petty, I don't believe he does. I was unable to find any case law in Virginia jurisprudence that requires you to do more. If you've made a motion to strike and you've raised an element of the offense as part of your motion to strike, that requires you to do anything further to preserve that. In fact, all of the cases say, even the case quoted by the Commonwealth on brief, says that all you need to do to preserve that sufficiency argument is to make a motion to strike at the conclusion of all the evidence. It's clear that the defendant did that. I could find no case in which something else beyond or further than that was required. All of the cases regarding proper preservation in a motion to strike all focus on what is said and raised during the motion to strike, and none that I could find focus on anything a defendant does or is required to do afterwards.
It seems to me that the issue here is not necessarily so much whether there was a motion to strike made or whether there was or was not evidence of intent to maim, disfigure, etc., but rather whether the court simply misspoke. It meant to refer to the element of malice as opposed to intent.
You know, I don't believe that's a reasonable interpretation of what the court said. The court could not have been more clear about what it actually said, finding that there was no proof of intent to maim, disfigure, disable, or kill. He then goes on to explain that in a manner entirely consistent with what he has clearly stated when he says that I don't think he was trying to do what happened to Mr. Austin. Even the Commonwealth concedes on brief that the court found that he did not intend to put out the eye of Mr. Austin. I don't think that without making, well, this is what he really meant to do, or perhaps he could have meant this, without twisting it in a way that just does not fit what the court actually said, the finding that he made, I would argue incredibly clearly that there's no way to make that argument in a way that I think is reasonable and stands up. And again, I think we, although it is not a published case, I would point again the court to the Williams case, which is incredibly similar to this one, and again, has the court making, you know, more than one statement regarding the intent, but convicting the defendant of the higher offense anyway. And that's what happened in that case, and the court, although in an unpublished opinion, you know, reversed the conviction there. And I think that the reason that it did that was because the defendant did exactly what is required of the defendant, is to make a motion to strike in which it raises the issue of the sufficiency of an element, and after that, that's all that the defendant is required to do. In this case, where we have, you know, a statement that could not be more clear than that there's no proof of intent to maim, disfigure, disable, or kill, and then an explaining statement that follows shortly after that that, you know, fits 100% with the original statement, I think it would be, twisting things too far to surmise or to guess that maybe what he really meant was something else. If it had been one isolated statement completely by itself, that I think that the argument would be better. But due to the absolute clarity of the court's finding, and then his referencing and backing it up, you know, in 100% consistency, I don't think that it would be in any way fair to Mr. Jones to make that leap that he really meant something else.
Well, counsel, this is Judge McCullough. Are you familiar with Code Section 801.384? That's the found in the civil, obviously 801 section, but we've applied it, and Supreme Court of Virginia has applied it in criminal cases too.
Isn't that the statute that says once an issue has been properly raised?
Right. I mean, it says formal exceptions to rulings are unnecessary if an exception has heretofore, you know, basically the point you're making, which is if you've stated your objection, you don't need to formally, as was done in the past, you have to continually stand up and say, well, we stand on our objection, we renew our objection, whatever. I don't know. I mean, it doesn't cleanly or squarely fit this case, but I thought I'd mention it because the Supreme Court of Virginia has been interested in that recently.
Yes, Your Honor. I think that it is interesting to look at this case in light of that as well, and mostly because it kind of fits into the scheme as we've laid out in the case law. It doesn't, you know, it doesn't do anything different. It comes to the same result. Under that statute, the issue would have been considered properly raised, and the defendant would not have had to do anything further. It appears under the case law that's the same thing when we specifically talk about motions to strike. Once it's been properly raised, nothing else further needs to be done. This is a situation in which there's, you know, the court hears evidence, it makes findings, and then it makes a legal conclusion. A very similar situation is when we have a motion to suppress. The court makes, you know, hears evidence, makes findings, and reaches a legal conclusion. And the rule is the same there. If you properly bring up all of the issues in the motion to strike, and the judge makes his findings and then makes his ruling, you're not required to make any kind of further objection. You've already, as long as you brought it up and properly covered it in your motion to suppress, you've already covered yourself, and regardless of how legally incorrect the judge's ruling might be, you're not required to do anything further. We would argue that, you know, that's just another example that fits in with the overall scheme of this case, where the defendant properly raised the issue, the judge made findings, and then a legal conclusion, and that the defendant was not required to do anything further. In the end, I think sometimes the proper remedy for a problem is, in fact, an appeal, and that's why we have them. That would be our position in this case, that the finding of the court was clear, that all of the case law points to the fact that once you've properly preserved it, as the defendant counsel did in this case, nothing further is required to be done. And, you know, as in the Fountain case, the judge made a finding that made conviction of that particular crime a legal error. And in this case, we would argue that the court made a finding that Bates' conviction of unlawful wounding an error, and we would ask the court to reverse the conviction. If the court doesn't have any further questions at this time, I'll reserve the balance of my time for rebuttal.
Right, you have 5 minutes left. Mr. Whitmer?
Good morning. May it please the court, to clarify the procedural default argument that the Commonwealth has presented with in the brief, it is simply that the defendant has presented an argument here that never was presented to the trial court, and that he has abandoned in his brief the arguments that were presented to the trial court. The only thing the assignment of error presents this court with a question about is whether the words spoken by the trial judge entitle the defendant to acquittal, and that's an issue that was never presented to the trial court. And so that is why the Commonwealth has argued that this is defaulted. It would be one thing if there had if he was arguing that one of the things that he did argue to the trial court, there were four separate grounds, including that there was insufficient evidence to prove that a weapon was used. If he was presenting the court with that claim, we wouldn't have a problem here. But as it is, because the basis for what the trial court said was not consistent with any of the arguments that were presented. It was a new remark, and assuming that remark were grounds for an acquittal, the defendant did have an obligation to speak up and say, whoa, Your Honor, you've just found there was not sufficient intent. Therefore, you have to, you're obliged to acquit. And the trial judge could have corrected his remark or agreed with the defendant as appropriate. Instead, what we have is we have a defendant who presented arguments to the trial court, and then after the fact he comes, abandons all those arguments, and just presents this court with a single claim based on a sentence out of the trial judge's mouth. We're arguing that the court should not embrace that and should not reverse on that ground.
Where was the Commonwealth's attorney here? Was everybody asleep in the courtroom?
Judge Petty, I don't know what to tell you. I've long suggested that the rule of two applies to criminal cases. At least two of the lawyers have to be doing their jobs properly, including the judge, to avoid error on appeal and avoid mistakes in a case. And it looks like,
you clearly got a factual finding that's inconsistent with the verdict and the sentence. And the question of whether that there was an intent was, as Mr. Ordero has raised, as mentioned, was raised before the trial court. So why don't we take the trial judge at his word on this and just say he mistakenly sentenced him for a crime he had effectively acquitted him of?
Well, I think the reason you can't do that is because the trial court speaks only through its orders, and when there's a divergence between a remark by the trial court on the record and the final order, this court reverts to review of the final order, and the final order clearly does convict the defendant of unlawful wounding. It's unambiguous, at the time that order was placed in front of the judge for his signature, nobody had brought to the judge's attention that he had made a remark on the record that was in any way inconsistent with that order he was entering. I don't really have anything else to say other than that if you review the record in the case, it's very clear upon the evidence presented that the evidence was legally sufficient to establish unlawful wounding, sufficient to allow the inference that a weapon was used, the victim was seriously injured, and we have statements by the defendant that to the effect that I was going to get him,
I think you put all that together, and you clearly do have sufficient evidence of criminal intent to sustain a conviction for unlawful wounding.
You mentioned the order of conviction, but that's not in the appendix. We just have the order of sentencing in there, which doesn't reflect whatever was said or done at the conclusion of the trial. Where does that leave us?
I'm not sure why we don't have that in the appendix. And it would appear to have been an oversight by the parties, but the entire record of the trial clearly is before this court for review, whether it's in the appendix or not.
Well, if the court speaks through its orders, it would be helpful to have the order before us so we could review of what the court spoke.
I would not disagree with you on that, Judge Petty. I would simply suggest that the appendix, while you know the parties should endeavor to make sure it contains all matters germane to an appeal, is a convenience volume for the court and the parties, and this court decides cases upon the record, and so this court is certainly able to go and look at the manuscript record to look at the conviction order itself. With those remarks, I would simply submit the case unless the court has further questions.
Hearing no further questions, we'll go on to Mr. Orguera. Any rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. Just briefly, the Commonwealth's argument about having abandoned our argument at the trial court, I think what we've tried to make clear is that our argument at the trial court was that there was not sufficient evidence of an intent to maim, disfigure, disable, or kill. In the motion to strike, defense counsel raised this multiple times. I know there's an instance on page 83 of the appendix. There's an instance on page 85 of the appendix. I believe he even offered a case on the subject of what is sufficient to prove an intent to maim, disfigure, disable, or kill. And then our argument in our assignment of error is simply that with the findings of the court on that issue, that it, an acquittal is required. And I think that has been properly preserved and not abandoned. I think the Commonwealth also talks about looking at the record of the evidence as a whole, and that there's plainly that there's enough evidence to make to infer that my client was in fact guilty of the crime. However, we would argue that once the judge makes a finding that there's not an intent to maim, disfigure, disable, or kill, the reviewing courts review that on a standard of whether that finding by the court was plainly wrong. And I don't think it is plainly wrong in this case because there was evidence that these men were friends, that their relationship went back a little bit, that this was something that just got a little out of hand. And, there was the testimony of the defendant himself who testified he had no such intent. So on that evidence, I think it's not possible for the court in this case to say that the finding of the judge that there was no intent to maim, disfigure, disable, or kill is plainly wrong.
What about our line of cases that says that we don't fix on isolated comments by a court? We look at the record as a whole. And here the record is pretty clear, other than that one statement that he did find sufficient evidence to convict of the felony.
Well, I would argue that, first of all, it's two statements. I think that they are pretty important statements. They're not isolated. They're not ambiguous in any way. And while they do make the ruling, legal ruling that the court made, an error, there's nothing, I would argue, that brings them into any doubt. The court does make some mention as it begins to rule about taking the Commonwealth's version of events, but then clearly says, I don't accept it all, I have a problem with it. And then he specifically says what the problem is, and then he specifically backs that up with a statement that dovetails 100% with what he said. I think we get beyond an isolated statement to something that's very clear, something that's repeated, and is not really out of place in the rest of what the judge has said. I would to take us back to Williams, where it's that same type of thing where the judge made, there was the number of statements the judge made in that case was, in fact, slightly greater, but I don't believe they were nearly as clear as they were in this case. So I think that's the proper way to handle this case. And again, I think it comes down to the way that we look at this case, and it's the judge made a finding that was clear, and it just means that he made a legal error in his conviction. And I think it's very close mostly on par with the Fountain case that I cited. The judge, you know, made a clear finding, but then convicted them, in opposite to the finding that had been made. And in that case, the court reversed, as well as the reversal in the Williams case. And that's is what I would ask the court to do in this case as well.
Very well. Thank you very much. That concludes concludes our docket for today. We appreciate everyone's argument, and that'll end us for now, and we'll reconvene in conference.